My name is Lynn Angelette, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And if you're new in Al-Anon, I did not come in here a grateful member of Al-Anon. I did not know why I had to go to these meetings because he had a problem. I want to thank Margaret, who has welcomed me to Ventura since we moved here, and welcomed me here. And last year, she invited me to Serenity by the Sea, and so I thought, well, we'll come and we'll meet all these people from Ventura. And we came and we sat at this table. And when we all went around to introduce ourselves, everybody was from Santa Barbara. So I just saw God laughing at us. I'd like to thank the AA committee and the Al-Anon committee for putting this on. I know how much work that is. And I appreciate that. I just want to say thank you, Jason, last night for your talk, and Steve for your talk. And when Steve was talking, all I kept thinking of is how my sponsor used to say to me, the only difference between an alcoholic and an Al-Anon is that the allergy to alcohol, because if when I drank, it made me a short, voluptuous blonde, I would have kept drinking. It didn't do that for me. So, but I had all the same feelings. And, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I grew up in a family that I used to say were normal. We were not normal. I grew up in a family that did not have alcoholism. Let me just put it that way. I have an older sister who's 7.5 years older than me. My parents had another baby that died at birth. And so my mother was told she could not have children, any more children. So they adopted my brother. And then I was the surprise that came along after. And So I was the baby of the family, and I took full advantage of that. I knew how to say, you know, when my I would tease my brother, he'd hit me, I'd cry, he'd get in trouble. It worked every time. And my parents enabled me all through school and everything. I read slowly, and everybody helped me with everything. And I was the little princess. But we didn't have any alcoholism or anything. But my mother was my mother ran the roost. We all said, she'd say jump, and we'd all say how high, including my father. And my mother was a rager, and she loved me a lot, and she loved us a lot, but she raged. And the reason I say that is when I came into Al-Anon, my only toolbox I had when I got angry was to rage, because I had turned into my mother. And I don't like to admit that, but that's what happened. And so anyway, so my mother told me, when it was time for me to date, that you meet a man of your same religious background that was going to be a professional, and you marry him, and you'll be happy the rest of your life. So when this poor boy was 16 years old and he asked me out on a date and he fit the criteria, I took him hostage for the next 10 years. And so we dated all through high school and all through college. And, you know, and I've learned in the program, it doesn't matter what your motives are. The only reason I graduated college is when I started college, my mother said, "You are our last hope for a college graduate." And I was more afraid of my mother's anger than my college professors. So I graduated. And, you know, and we dated for 7 years, and it was expected that we got engaged, and it was expected we got married. And I didn't know how to get out of it. And I remember saying to my mom, "Maybe we should wait," because he wasn't going to graduate till December. "Maybe we should wait." And she said, I was all of 21 years old, "You'll be an old maid if you do not get married now." So so I married the man of my mother's dreams, and we were married. And this is the part of my story I don't like to tell, although you have given me a nicer way to tell it. We were married about a year and a half, and I had an overlapping relationship. And not proud of that. So my ex-husband, I made his life so miserable, he asked me for a divorce, and I got to walk away scot-free. Now, for those of you who are new in the program, you don't get to be scot-free, because I did have to call. I made amends to him. I'll talk about that later. And the man that I thought my ex-husband was really boring. It didn't occur to me that I was boring too. And so I hooked up with this guy who was really exciting. I didn't notice how much he drank. I just knew he was very exciting. And I can't call him an alcoholic because, I don't. As far as I know, he doesn't call himself an alcoholic. But his drinking bothered me. And I learned how to do things. I learned how to wait up till 4 in the morning for him to get home so I could get in bed and pretend I was sleeping so he didn't know I was waking up. And And that when he got home at 4 a.m. and said, oh, I'm hungry, I'd get up and I'd make him something to eat because he was so nice to me the next day. It took me a long time to realize that you're not supposed to be treated badly before you're treated well. But that became our pattern. So it was okay whatever he did because the next day he would be so nice to me. That anger came up, you know, when he was not violent in our relationship. What happened is he'd call my mother a four-letter word and I'd slap him in the face, you know, and I'm not proud of that, but that was my anger. I didn't even know I had that much anger. And so it turned into, and I'm not saying I didn't love him. I'm sure I loved him and I'm sure he loved me, but we were like oil and water together. And this was before cell phones, and I threatened to leave, and I'd go and I'd drive to the nearest phone booth and ask him if I could come back. And if you don't know what phone booth is, Google it. It was insane. So what happened was I did this in Sandy for 3 years. And during that time, and then what happened is we decided that if we just lived apart and we didn't live together, then life would be good. So I moved home. And I have to tell you, I did not have a God when I came in here, but I can look back and see how God was taking care of me this whole time. And I moved home in November. I was 26 years old and with my parents. And I'll be forever grateful for that because in January of that year, my mother was killed in a car accident. And I had those 3 months at home to be with my mother and make amends to my mother. Because what I do when I'm in a situation like that with an alcoholic is I don't call people because I don't want you to know what's happening in my life. I come from the fine family. We always look fine on the outside. You watch us at a family thing, everybody at the door is... You get inside, all hell breaks loose. But we look fine on that front porch, you know? And I can remember after my mom died, and this relationship was falling apart. I'd already moved home. And I remember being at work and walking down the hall, and somebody says, what's wrong? You're not smiling. And one more time, I put on that phony smile, and I said, I don't know. I must just be having a bad day, because I didn't know how to tell you I was dying inside. I just kept it. I just stuffed all those feelings and stuffed them all and just kept that smile on so you'd think I was okay. And then in January, he called me and he told me that he was really sick and could I take him to the emergency hospital, and I did. And he had hepatitis. And I remember the feelings of, and I think this was my hardest thing about living with somebody that was that drank a lot, is my first thought when he said he had hepatitis was, oh good, he won't be able to drink. And then all the guilt I felt that I love this man and I'm glad he's sick. And you know, a month later when he told me the doctor said he could drink again, I believed him. Because I believed everything he said. And so we kept going on like this, and then the beginning of the end was he asked me to his company Christmas party. Now, I don't know how the alcoholics in your life did this, but first they went out to drink at lunch to get ready, and then they met at a bar after work to get more ready for the party. So by the time we went to the party, he had already drank quite a lot, and when he fell on the floor in front of his bosses on the dance floor, we decided maybe it was time to leave. And he drove me down by the beach, and he told me to get out of the car. And I did. Before Al-Anon, I never had choices. It never once occurred to me to call a cab, to call my parents, to call a friend. My best thinking said I had to walk back to that bar. Oh, we left my car at a bar, too. That was so... I thought my ego said I couldn't walk down the brightest street because somebody might see me. And so I walked down the darkest street, you know, and I... This is where I know I have a God, because a man pulled up across the street and he said, do you have another car? I have a car that needs to be jump-started or something. And I said, no. And he said, and they said, look, you're obviously in trouble and need to get to your car. I swear I won't touch you. If you get in the car with me, I'll take your car. You can help me jumpstart my car. And you know what? I got in the car with that man, and he did have another car that needed to be jumpstarted. He drove me to my car. We helped jumpstart his car. And the only thing that man did is he asked me for my phone number at work, and he called me the next day to make sure I got home okay. Now, even after all that, the first thing I did was drive over to that man's apartment, and he wasn't home. So I drove, we were in Santa Monica, I drove all the way back to the San Fernando Valley where my parents live, and my mom goes, where have you been? He's been arrested for drunk driving, and he called for us to bail him out. So we went, got in the car, I had no collateral or anything, I was so humiliated, my parents had to bail him out of jail. And then when we got him out of jail and he got in the car, he said to me, why did you leave that party with the girl I work with? I didn't know anything about blackouts. And I said, that's not what happened. And he called me a liar in front of my parents. And I thought, this is over. I'm done. I'm humiliated enough. This is over. And, you know, I got home at 3 a.m. But, you know, I am the worker. So the next morning I got up and I went to work with my smile on my face. And he called the next day with those three famous words, I need you. So now, of course, it's going to be different. So I went back. And we played this game, you know, this game on and off game for a while. And then my knight in shining armor over there, I worked with him. And on his last day at work, because he doesn't believe you date people you work with, and his last day at work, I just happened to be in the parking lot for some reason, and he was leaving, and he asked me for my phone number. And I'd never given anybody my phone number. I had stayed loyal to this man, and I gave him my phone number. And then it was so funny because we both worked in Lakewood, and we both lived in West L.A., which I did not know. And I get on the freeway, and he's following me, and he's following me. And we get off at the same off-ramp. Thank God he turned right, and I turned left, because I thought, now I've given my number to a stalker. The next day, I went to see that man, and I broke it off because I did not want to have another overlapping relationship. And you know, Bruce asked me to date. He asked me out, and on our first date, he said, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, this cannot be happening to me again. And then after we were dating about a month, he said, do you want to hear me talk? And he was 4.5 years sober, and I heard him talk. Let me tell you, that was way more information than somebody you should know about somebody after you've dated for a month. And then 3 months, our first date was November 14th, and 3 months to the day after we started dating, he took me up to the top of the Mark in San Francisco, and he asked me to marry him. Now, He did tell me before, and I need to share with you that this. He said to me that his AA program would come first, and he would go to 3 to 5 meetings a week the rest of his life, and if I could not live with that, we couldn't get married. Bruce last summer celebrated 45 years of sobriety, and he still goes to 3 to 5 meetings a week. Not that I have a resentment, some weeks 6 or 7, but anyway. But the other thing he said was, and I didn't have a God at this time, but he said, if God wants us to be together, there's nothing I was going to do to mess it up. And if God didn't want us to be together, there was nothing I was going to do to keep us together. So if I gained 5 pounds, he wasn't out the door. But on the other hand, if I held him by his ankles, he wasn't staying. And I said to him, I was scared. We'd only dated 3 months. And he informed me that 3 months was a long-term relationship in AA. And I have to tell you, it took me 6 weeks to say yes, and that was because I'd never forgiven myself for what I did to my ex-husband, and I thought if I married another nice guy, I'd get bored and I'd screw him over, and I was so afraid. Now, my friend Michelle says Bruce and I live in a two-story house, his story and my story, and this is where it comes. I thought I woke up one day and said, okay, I'm ready to get married. Bruce said, I said, the train's moving on, get on or get off. And I don't remember that, but I'm sure the story's somewhere in between. So we got married in that August, and then Bruce's sponsor's wife, Ruby, took me to my first Al-Anon meeting, and I was smug, arrogant, and self-righteous. They said that they didn't have babysitting, and I got a resentment. I didn't have any children. And all I remember is this lady said, my husband dropped his socks in the living room, and I stepped over them, and I didn't pick them up, and everybody went, and I thought, oh, I must be in the wrong place. I'd come home from the, and I came home, and it took me, if you are new, please do not follow my path. It took me 6 months to go to my next meeting, and what happened is, it was like so stupid, but Bruce had a closed AA meeting at our house on Monday night, so I hid upstairs. Don't ask me why, it never occurred to me I could go out, but I hid upstairs, and I was allowed to come down at the coffee break, and I came down, and one of his friends said, this is Bruce's wife, and I thought, I have a name. All I am is Bruce's wife now. That's all I wanted to be, but now it was not okay. And I realized I had all the stuff I thought would make me okay. I had the husband, I had the house, I had the job, and I still didn't like who I was. So I went back to an Al-Anon meeting, and this is the honest truth. I was 27 years old, and I thought all of you were between 100 and death. You were so old. And when I started Al-Anon, you remember this, the people knitted, the needles, you hear them all. And but God took care of me because I sat where Margaret was, and a young gal sat here, and she stood up and she said her boyfriend was 5 years sober, and that's what Bruce was. And she said, I've never seen him take a drink. And for some reason, God had me go up to her, and I said, are there meetings with younger people? And she said, I will be in Marina Del Rey Monday night. I'll have a seat for you. So I went. And then she said, tomorrow night I'll be in Culver City. I'll have a seat for you. And I went. And she said, Friday night I'll be at Chelsea and Wiltshire. I'll have a seat for you. And I went. I have to tell you, you did not need to save seats at my meetings. But she did, and I kept going. And plus, they didn't have newcomers packets back then. And so someone bought me a 5-cent pamphlet, and I thought I owed them, so I had to keep going back. You know, and I was not one. I'd come home and I'd say to Bruce, how long do I have to go to these meetings? And he'd say, until you want to. And, you know, and he was always a really good example of the program. And I knew about a sponsor. I knew about a sponsor. And so I got a sponsor, but I asked somebody who had 6 more months than I did on the program because I didn't want them to ask me to work the steps or go to meetings. And I'd call her once a month to check in. And you know what? She was the perfect sponsor for me. She had a great spiritual program, which I didn't have, and she was kind and loving to me every time I called. She never beat me up for not calling, and she was kind and loving. And so, and I did get involved in service right away because Bruce was involved in service. And when your meeting says you're ready to do something, please believe them and do it. Don't say no. And my first commitment was food, and this meeting was in Beverly Hills, and they had fruit spreads and all this stuff. I'd walk up and down the aisle to find the best cookies. I didn't know you don't fire the cookie chairman. I'm surprised I didn't bake. I guess I wasn't as sick as I thought. Anyway, you know, if you don't want to take your fourth step, get involved in service, somebody will take it for you. And, you know, I learned so much from being of service. I remember one night I cut up all this fruit, and I knew all of you made better looking fruit platters than me. Don't ask me how, but I knew. And so I said to somebody, they said, can I help you? And I said, yes, you can put the fruit out. They dumped it in a mound on the tray. I'm here to tell you, everybody ate all the fruit. Nobody said what ugly fruit trays they were. What a chink that was at my perfectionism. I mean, I was such a perfectionist. I remember somebody helped me one night. We had an AA birthday party at our house. Little did I know. Anyway. And I'm making nachos, and they said, can I help? And they cut the tomatoes up, and they didn't cut them as small as I would have. I was sure everybody was going to hate the nachos. Anyway, I did not know after I handmade every appetizer because I couldn't buy anything. And if one more alcoholic said to me, when are you going to serve the cake? I was like, not until you eat every one of these appetizers I slaved over all day long. I mean, that was me. Nothing for fun and for free back then. Anyway, enough about my cooking stories. So I did get involved in service early on. And then I had 1 year in the program, and Bruce said, no self-respecting AA would have their first year birthday without doing a four-step inventory. And I did inform him, and Al-Anon, we do it in our own way and pace. But I was starting to feel guilty, so I asked somebody to sponsor me who had 19 years in the program. She had a very different idea of sponsorship. She said, we're going to do the steps from 1 to 12 without skipping 2 to 11 in the middle. And her favorite word was write. When I'd call her, she'd say, write about it and call me back. But she taught me such valuable things. I remember one day I had to share something with Bruce, and I called her. I said, I'm afraid. And she said, what's the worst thing that could happen? I said, he'll divorce me. She said, so what? You've been divorced before. You've lived through it. You'll live through it again. And I was like, what? You know, but, you know, I told him, obviously, we've been married 40 years. He didn't divorce me. But what happened is I had to work those steps, and I you know, step one, I've still, my life becomes unmanageable, and I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over people, places, and things. The only thing, you know, we talked about this morning. I went to my morning meeting before I came here, and I said, you know, if I am not the problem, there is no solution. If I'm the problem, there's a solution, and I had to learn that. So I'm powerless, all of you. I can't make you change so I'm more comfortable. I have to be the one that changes. And the second step about insanity, I learned about insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. You know, And I did that all the time, you know. And when I got to the third step, I went over my sponsor's house, and I'm sorry if I offend anybody because my sponsor did this out of the big book, but this is how she did it. My sponsor said, "Have you done the third step prayer?" And I said, "Yeah, I did it with Bruce." And she said, "Well, now you'll do it like an Al-Anon does it with another Al-Anon." And we got on our knees and we said the third step prayer from the big book, and I read her my fourth step, which was 120 of the most boring pages you've ever heard in your life. And I'm surprised she didn't fall asleep. And then she said to me, "Are you entirely ready to have..." Oh, she had a list of character defects. I walked in there with no character defects. She had a list of character defects from my inventory, and she said, "Are you entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character?" Of course, people-pleasing was on there, so I said, "Yes, of course I am," you know? And so we said the seven-step prayer, and we asked God to remove my defects of character. You know, my defects of character come to visit me today. They don't live with me anymore, and I have to ask God on a daily basis to remove those defects of character. She also made a list of people I owed amends to, which I also had to think about because, you know, and I just want to share with you a couple of my amends that changed my life. One was to my ex-husband. When I called him, my worst nightmare happened. His wife answered the phone. I thought, "Oh God, I hope she doesn't think I want him back." And so I told her, "Well, you know, I'm in the 12-step program, blah, blah," and she goes, "I'll have him call you back." And it took him 2 days to call me back, and, you know, I thought to myself, okay, I tried, I don't have to do anything. And when I talked to him, I said, "You know, I'm sorry." My sponsor said, "You don't tell him anything that would hurt him." So all I said was, "We had worked on this. I am sorry for my part in the breakup of our marriage." And he said, "You know, we were young, and you don't owe me an amends." And then he said, "And the hurt goes away." And, you know, he was the first person that ever confronted me with the fact I could hurt somebody. And that was, that made me keep my road so much clearer. I'm so grateful. And I've also made amends because his sister is in Al-Anon, and she has heard the whole story because his family blamed him for the divorce, and she knows his truth now, and she's heard me speak, and I felt like that was my end to my amends. But I have to tell you, when your sponsor tells you it's time to make your amends, do it, because you don't know why. Because like a few months later, we had our son at Disneyland, and he had his son at Disneyland and his wife, and my husband said, "Aren't you glad you didn't have to make amends on Main Street?" So there you go. So when your sponsor tells you to do something, do it. And, you know, and the other amends was to my father. After my mother died, my father became the swing single of the San Fernando Valley. And so when I made my amends to him in my dramatic fashion, all he said was to me was, "Did I tell you I have a date Thursday night?" And I have to tell you, my dad, I learned that my amends was for me. It wasn't for him. But, you know, the real amends I made to him was, and I made amends to my mother's graveside, but the real amends I made to my father was being the best daughter I could be to him. You know, and my family did not say, "I love you." And I remember my sponsor said, "If you want him to say, 'I love you,' you need to do it first." And so I remember we were hanging up on the phone one day, and I said, "I love you. Bye." And then next time, "I love you. Bye." Well, you know, after about 5 or 6 times, my father said, "I love you." And he started doing that from then on. You can't give what you don't have. My parents did the best they could with what they had. They weren't taught that. That's not how they were brought up. And when my husband and I got married, he said to me, "I will never live in a house with 3 generations again." I did that growing up. When my dad was dying of leukemia, it became obvious my brother lived in a 3-story apartment with no elevator, and my sister lived in Las Vegas, that we would have to take him in our home. And we took him in our home, and it was an honor and a privilege to take care of my father. And I have to tell you, you do what you have to do. I never thought I could change my father's diapers, and I knew it was more humiliating for him than it was for me. And you do what you have to do. And my dad lived with us those 4 months. Now, my father was hilarious. He told jokes. He had that, he'd say anything to anybody. I had no sense of humor when I came into Al-Anon, none. I would watch I Love Lucy and feel bad for Lucy, no sense of humor. I was just like my mother, you know? I remember one day my sponsor was at a birthday party at our house, and my dad was there, and she came up to me afterwards, and she said, "Are you sure that's your dad? He's so funny." And I was like, anyway, when my dad was dying, I was able to give him my sense of humor. I was able to laugh with him, and what a gift that was, and that was a gift directly from you guys. And I'm forever grateful for that. And it was a hard time, but you do what you have to do. So I want to go back to when Bruce and I got married, we decided when we were married a year, we were going to have a baby. Well, no, I decided when we were married a year, we were going to have a baby. And as you can see, those of you who know my husband, he's a little older than me. He's 16 years older than me. So when he married me, he did not think children were ever going to be in the picture. So we were married a year and we didn't want to have a baby. We're still having fun. And we said to our sponsors, how do you know when it's time? And they said, when it's time, you'll know. And we were, about 6 months later, we decided it was time and God had a different plan for us. And we went through infertility treatment and you laugh with us and you cried with us in these rooms. And I'd come in and I'd say, I'm not doing anymore. I can't do it. And the next week I'd have an intravenous needle on my arm attached to a pump on my waist. And you would love me anyway. And the reason I say that is because one of you is going to go to your meeting next week and say, I'm leaving the alcoholic. I can't stand it. And then all week when you go back the next day, you worry that I'm not going to be able to go back to my meeting. And we love you no matter what. You need to go back as many times as you need to go back. Nobody's going to tell you not to. And so... when I wound up in the hospital, people said to us that, you know, we kept saying we're not going to stop before the miracle. People said, God whispers to you, and if you don't listen, he shouts. And he was shouting that we needed to stop this insanity. And a woman that worked for me part-time came in and said, I work part-time in a gynecologist's office, and she wants to give a baby up for adoption. Would you like to talk to her? Now, Bruce was not comfortable with adoption. I have an adopted brother, and my brother looks like my twin. I mean, I was very comfortable with adoption. And so my sponsor said, you have to wait until he's comfortable. And he comes home one day from work, and he said, I'm comfortable now. We can adopt. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. Somebody said you don't give birth to a puppy, and you love a puppy. I'm ready to adopt. Now... this is what you have told me in Al-Anon. When I'm going to get my way to shut up and say, oh, that's really nice, dear. And so I did. We interviewed with this couple, and this lady picked us. She was 3 or 4 months pregnant, and I talked to her all during her pregnancy. And she had a beautiful baby boy, and we were at the hospital when the baby was born. We had the baby home and I had quit my job. I was going to be a stay-at-home mom, and 13 days later, we got a call from our lawyer that she changed her mind and she wanted the baby back. And I called Bruce at work, and Bruce called the sponsor, and a sponsor got there, and his sponsor held us, and he held the baby, and he said the Serenity Prayer, and he said, God doesn't take something out of your life unless he's going to replace it with something better, but when you're waiting in the hallway, it can be hell. And my friend Jack says, put up curtains in the hall because you don't know how long you're going to be in the hallway. And so we gave that baby back. I didn't have my job to make me okay, and I didn't have a baby to make me okay, and I was going to have to be okay by myself. We went to a lawyer, and then I got a call from a woman in Portland, Oregon, and she said, I have a 4-and-a-half-month-old baby boy. Would you be interested? And I thought, oh, I don't want to go through anybody's pregnancy with him again. And so I said, call our lawyer. And she called, and the lawyer called back and said, she wants to know if you have any alcohol in your background because her father's an alcoholic. And I said, you know, there's that moment. They say the road gets narrower. And I thought I could lie and nobody would ever know. And I just said, Bruce is 10 years sober and I'm 5 years in Al-Anon. And if she's not comfortable with us, I'm sure you have another couple that you can give her. And she called back and said she was familiar with AA and Al-Anon, and did we want to come up to Portland? And we came up and we brought our son Jason home, and he is better than the first. And I have people here that can vouch for that. Jason was our pride and joy. He, in the elementary school, Jason is smart as a whip. I mean, I can say this because he does not have our genes. I remember when they tested him for gait when he was in third grade, the psychologist calls me and she goes, he's got the thinking ability of a 12-year-old, but he's only got the verbal ability of a 10-year-old, and that concerns me. I thought, he's only 8. Why am I concerned, you know? So needless to say, he has out-manipulated Bruce and I from the get-go. And in elementary school, he made us look really good. You know, he did everything right. He um, we had a teacher ask us if we were going to have another one, you know, because he was so good. And anyway, and I do have to tell you, we did at one point, I wanted to have a second child. Bruce did not. And I wanted to adopt a second one, and Bruce did not. And my sponsor said something to me, and please, please listen to your sponsors, even though you think they're full of you-know-what. My sponsor said to me, his no is more important than your yes, because he will resent for you for the next 18 years if you do it and it's not what he wants. So again, he gave in, and we tried to adopt another one, and the kind of same thing happened, and so we decided we were done and we were just gonna have the one. And then Jason hit junior high school and life changed, my push me toy became a push me pull me toy, you know, and he no longer, and it got very quiet in our house, or else we were yelling and screaming. And this child who graduated elementary school, two elementary schools, one in fifth grade and one in sixth, with presidential honors, was now by eighth grade flunking out of junior high school. And he was diagnosed with ADHD, and Bruce and I were spending a lot of time at meetings at school. And in the middle of all this, I had stopped working. I stayed home for 11 years, and I had gone back to work. And so when we had these meetings with the counselor and all the teachers, his counselor would say, you know, his mother works and goes to school. And I think, yeah, let's put the blame on me. We finally decided by eighth grade that, and it was a hard decision, that a friend of mine said, my son goes to this private school, and you have to be gifted or nearly gifted to get in, and you have to have a reason you're not succeeded in public schools. You should check it out. And we checked it out, and we went through it, and I have to tell you, Bruce and I walked out and said, this is like one flew over the cuckoo's nest, and Jason walked out and said, I'm so comfortable here. And so, you know, we called our sponsors, and we said, we can't afford private school, and our sponsor said, can you afford it this year? We said, yes, and they said, you better know that God is going to provide for every other year, and you put him in the school. And you know, during those years, it was ugly at our house. It was either silent or there was screaming and yelling. And we had been a really close family, and it was ugly. It was ugly. I felt like he, like my friend said, he outgrew my parenting skills. And so he finally made it to 12th grade, like 3 days before his graduation, we get a call. Monday of his graduation, we were supposed to graduate Friday. Thursday we get a call, and they said that they said he owed three papers, and if he didn't write them, then he wasn't going to graduate. Now I have to go back to what I told you. I read slowly, and my family all helped me write my papers, but they would also take credit. And when I did go back to school, when I was in Al-Anon to get my master's degree, I did it all by myself. I mean, Bruce, I'd write a paper and he'd type one while I was typing the other, but I wrote them all myself. And I knew when I got that degree, I knew what it felt like to stand up there and get it on my own. And so I called my sister and I said, you guys can come from Las Vegas, but I don't know if we're having a graduation. And my sister said, write the papers. And I said to her, you know what, he'll either have the dignity to graduate high school on his own or he's not graduating. I'm not writing a paper for him. And so 3 hours before he graduates, we get a call from the school. Oh, he's graduating. He just thought it'd be funny if you didn't know. So today it's a funny story. It was not funny then. Now, you have to picture this graduation. He had 12 kids in his graduating class. His English teacher gives the speech, and he says, you know, I learned a lot from your kids. I learned how to find porn on a cell phone from your kids. I learned how to be patient because they kept saying they'd turn in their papers, and they never did. And he said, and I would tell them all how they should spend their life, but they all have ADHD and they won't remember tomorrow. Yay, 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 they all graduated, you know. But it was like being at an Al-Anon meeting, because all the parents there we knew had been through the same thing, trying to get these kids just to graduate high school. And of course, Bruce and I, with our ego and everything, thought we were the only ones in our family that ever graduated college. He has to graduate college. And Jason told us clearly at 18 years old he didn't want to go to college, that he wanted to start a business. Would we invest in a business? And we knew better. We thought we knew better. And so he's no fool. When we said, we're not supporting you if you're not in college, he went to college. And I have to tell you, and I'll get back to this later, and I hope I don't cry, while we were going through this at 18 years old, and I thought, we can't parent this child. I don't know what's going on. Somebody else stepped in and parented him. Somebody at an AA meeting said to Bruce, you have a son, don't you? And he said, yeah. He goes, I need some help in my shop. Can he come help me? And Jason and Bruce said, yes. And that man has parented Jason for the last 18 years and helped us and his wife. And they call themselves Jason's other parents, and I'm okay with that, you know, because they gave him what we couldn't. They gave him what we couldn't. God stepped in for us. But so he went to college. By the way, we don't give advice in Al-Anon, but when you tell your child that, you have to say, going to college and getting credits, because Jason knows how to go to college. He just never finishes the class. So he wanted to go to Utah, and believe me, by then we were ready for him to go. And he went to Utah, and he came back. And then he got this great idea. He's going to go to Humboldt. And Betty Ann says to me, he's going to go to the pot capital of the world. All I heard was, then maybe he'll graduate, you know. And so he went up to Humboldt, and he came back. He came back when he was 19 years old, and one day he went crazy in our house, and he knocked two holes in walls, and we were packing, we were going to leave, we didn't know what to do, and then he calmed down. No, before he calmed down, he said, Bruce goes, Jason, if you don't stop acting like this, I'm going to have to call the police. And Jason said, if you do, Dad, I'll kill you before they get there. And then he calmed down, and I never thought our family would ever come back together again after that. But our programs are both based on forgiveness. And that's when, and I'm sure he was high on something that day. And he said, I have to tell you something, but I'm afraid you're not gonna love me if I tell you. And he said, I've been smoking pot since I was 12 years old. And then of course he had to add, that had nothing to do with how our relationship changed. Okay. And so I didn't say anything to him because I thought, and, you know, we had been, I mean, talk about denial. We had so many years in program by then. Denial, right? Bruce, did you burn fish? I smell something in the house. No, nobody's burning fish. You know, it was like right under our face, and we didn't want to see it. And anyway, so then he decided again he was going back to school, and he came back. And when he came back, he was living with us. And, you know, here I told you how smart he is, and we said to him, no drugs or alcohol in our house. Well, somehow Jason did not feel like we paid for our garage, too, that was not part of our house. So there was no drugs or alcohol in our house, but we would come out, and there would be, like, trash cans full of beer cans and bottles and everything else. And you know, there were some, you know, some funny things that happened during that time and some tragic things. And I don't snoop because I'd rather be in denial than know the truth. Thank you very much. And one day we went out on a Sunday morning to go someplace, and first we found Jason's cell phone in the bushes, which is never a good sign. And then we went by his truck and to get in our car, and there was something that he had been arrested in, and he bailed himself out of jail. And I have to tell you, I don't think he ever was charged with anything or anything because he never had to go to court, but I'm so forever grateful that he did that, because I stand up here. I have 40 years in Al-Anon. I don't know if I would have bailed him out or not. I'm not going to stand up here and say, oh, yeah, I'm a black belt. I don't know what I would have done. I don't know what I would have done. But I didn't have to make that decision. You know, there was another time I was at my Thursday night meeting, and I get a call from my neighbor. My phone keeps ringing, and she said, the police brought Jason home. He was, I don't know what he was doing. And they wouldn't let him in because he didn't have his key. He lost his key, and they wouldn't let him in. So I came home, and I let him in. And, you know, then we had some funny things. I mean, we're big college football people, and Jason was away, and so we had given away our other two tickets, and it was the big game, and he was a little resentful that we didn't have a ticket for him. And so when we're driving home, he goes, and we had won by a lot, and he goes, Mom, I have a surprise for you. I'm thinking streamers, a little surprise. So we walk in the house, and in our entry hall, which was the only floor I loved in our house, he had painted in letters like this big, the two team scores on for the game. And he's like, he was there with his, he was a little drunk with his ex-girlfriend, who was a little drunk. And I walked in, and thank God for Al-Anon, I said nothing. I just said, well, we have to go to bed. This is how it goes. Now, this is a child that grew up in AA meetings. He's been in AA meetings since he was like 6 months old, so he knew about, you know. And then Monday night, Bruce goes to his AA meeting, and he looks at me and says, Mom, Dad's going to kill us if we don't clean this floor. Dad's going to kill us. And then he says, and so he gives me some stuff and he goes, now don't breathe because this causes cancer. So I'm like, you know, cleaning the floor. So, you know, I can laugh about that today, but, you know, but it was hard. It was hard. I had so much anger. All that anger came up again. And he just knew I installed his buttons, so he knew how to push them, you know. And it was an ugly time in our house. And then, you know, we finally got off of, I thought, I don't care if he, I don't care if he ever goes to college, you know. And my sponsor has five children, and they're all in AA or Al-Anon, and she would say to me when to get upset and when it was okay. And you know, we kept doing this and until we had to keep doing this. And then I surrendered. He didn't need to go to college. He didn't need to. And his Eskimo took him and let him work. He has worked for him, and he went to work for him, and he stopped going to college. We stopped trying to get him to go to college, and that was what he was meant to do in his life. He is so talented, and that is what he was meant to do. And thank you. So what changed my life is I started going to parent-focused meetings, and that changed my life. I learned this one sentence that saved my life. Wait for the question. Very rarely is there a question. You know, our kids don't say, Mom, how should I do this? Very rarely. Bruce always knows when I'm on the phone with Jason and he asks a question because I'll start, you know, because I know I can tell him what I want to do, you know. And it changed my life. What happened is I wrote 2 years of inventories about Jason. The steps of this program saved my life. The fellowship is great. I love everybody, but the steps of these programs saved my life. I wrote 2 years of inventory on him, and what came out of those 2 years of inventory is I had such a financial... We kept throwing money at the problem, throwing money at the problem, throwing money at the problem. It never solved anything, and we got in big debt because of it, and I had such resentment for Jason. So I wrote this inventory, and then Bruce came home and said that somebody in AA that was also in Al-Anon, we were going to go show him all our finances and he was going to help us. I would have rather walked in naked to that restaurant than showed everybody our finances because I thought he was going to say, what are you guys, idiots? The first thing he said to us before we started was, when my son was in college and I was paying for everything, including his apartment, I went to visit him. He had a cleaning lady cleaning his apartment, and I came home and my wife was scrubbing our toilets. And I thought, okay, I can tell him anything. He helped us clear up our finances. By this time I wrote these 2 years inventory, our finances were fine. And so what happened is I realized that was on me, that I spent that money. Jason clearly told us at 18 he didn't want to go to college. I spent that money because I was trying to control him and get him to go to college. And that was on me, so I could let go of that resentment. The other thing is, I was able to say to him when he was 26 years old, if we keep supporting you in the way we're supporting you, we're never, ever going to be able to retire. And you know what? He has not asked us for any money from that day on. I wish I'd done it when he was 19. But anyway, we do it when we're ready. And I have to tell you, as a result of that, not that I'm counting the days, I have 29 more days till I retire. And the other thing that came out in those resentments is I developed compassion for him, because I absolutely know during those times that he needed to take those, whatever he was taking, drinking or whatever, to deal with the feelings he had. He never drank at me once. He did it because he needed to do it for him, not because of me. The other thing here's the bad news I'm here to tell parents. My sponsor told me when I got down on it that I needed to go to one AA meeting a week, because how could I have compassion for a disease I don't know about? I have gone to meetings with Bruce for 40 years, to AA meetings. I have never once heard an AA speaker say, my mom said to get sober, and I ran out and got sober. Never have I heard that. I've heard them say, my mom took my money away, took this, that, and they got sober. But never, my mom said, it's a good idea to get sober. And I said, yay, I'm glad you thought of that. I think I'll go do that right now. So today, I don't know if Jason drinks or not. I it's none of my business. I never ask him. I think a year ago, I smelled alcohol on his breath once, and I said, Bruce, I smell alcohol on his breath. And he said, so what? He's 35 years old. So what? He can drink, you know? And we have a good relationship today. We have a good relationship. I accept him the way he is. And I love him. And And, you know, I laugh because, you know, Mother's Day is in a couple of weeks. And, you know, Jason would not remember a holiday. He gets mad because why can't the employees work when it's a holiday? He would work. And so I just said to him, I have it planned. I want you and Dad to come help me with my work, finish it up on Mother's Day. Whether he shows up or not, I don't care. It's okay. But I've learned to ask for what I want. Is my time up? Okay. And my time is up. And I just have one thing I want to say, and I want to share something that from Winnie Eddy, because this changed my life. Winnie Eddy said her sponsor asked her once, how do you serve a cake? And Winnie Eddy said, I give everybody a piece, and whatever's left, I take for me. And her sponsor said, did it ever occur to you the way you live your life is you give everybody a piece, and whatever's left, you take. Today, I take that first piece of cake and give you what's left. Thank you.
Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12steptapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.